This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's been nearly 125 years since a headless body was found in Campbell County, prompting media at the time to refer to the woman's murder as the crime of the century. Since that time, the life and death of Pearl Bryan has become part of Northern Kentucky folklore. The story of the killing and the investigation and trial of Bryan's murderers are now part of a new book, The Betrayal of Pearl Bryan, Unraveling the Gilded Age Mystery That Captivated a Nation. Author Larry Tippin, who is also the Putnam County, Indiana historian, is set to speak on the story this week at the Tower Park Mess Hall in Fort Thomas. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Larry. If you have questions or comments about the Pearl Bryan story and its connections to our area, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. So, Larry, you write in this book, most of the previous publications of Pearl Bryan begin the morning of February 1, 1896, with the discovery of a headless body in the Cincinnati suburb of Fort Thomas, Kentucky. However, for 23-year-old Pearl Bryan, this is not where the story begins, but rather where it ends. So, who was Pearl Bryan?
Yeah, thank you. That's great. Let me tell you first how the story came about. I'm a county historian in Putnam County. I do a lot of presentations. And I happened to be doing a presentation at our county museum in Greencastle. We're west of Indianapolis. And in the presentation, I just briefly mentioned the frustration about the lack of good information on Pearl Bryan's story. And it happened to be some Bryan family members were in the audience. And they came up after and mentioned that, do you know that we're related to Pearl? And I thought, oh my gosh, no, I did not know that. I've known these people all my life. One of the Bryans, delivered my mail until just recently when she retired. And I never thought to put the two and two together between their name and the Bryan name. So I thought that got me kind of going a little bit. They also said there's no local history on it at all. And there's no family folklore. The elders, the previous elders, really didn't want to talk about the story. It was too much of an open wound to them, not just what happened to Pearl, but what the story has become. And it's very offensive to the Bryan family, some of the things that have been said about Pearl. So my dear friend Tony Ford and I decided to come down here and did some research, and we found the trial transcripts were still available after all these years. So I did a very thorough review of the trial transcripts, the contemporaneous newspaper accounts, and other primary source documents, and I was able to get the questions answered and be able to reconstruct what really happened to Pearl.
So I imagine there were a lot of Bryans in the Greencastle area in that time, or maybe even still, because you note that she was one of 12 children in her family. So there are still a number of them in that area.
That's right. Pearl was 11 to 12 children, and the Bryan family was a very hardworking and prosperous family. Her father owned 640 acres of prime farmland and had a dairy operation and was worth probably at least $2 million in today's money. And there were a lot of Bryans there, and many of them have stayed. The Bryan family has moved on, of course, different places, but many of the Bryan family has six and seven generation descendants.
So she came from means. Their family had money at the time of...
Yeah, their family was very hardworking family at the time, yes.
So I want you to take us to that February day in 1896 in Fort Thomas. What were the circumstances around the discovery of her body?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about how the story came about and why Pearl ended up over here. In the year 1896, 23-year-old Pearl Bryan found out she was pregnant, not married, conservative Midwestern family. That's not really going to be a favorable thing. So she came to Cincinnati, told her family she was going to go to Indianapolis to visit a friend, but instead came to Cincinnati, where the father of her unborn child was a student at the Cincinnati Dental College, with the intention of convincing him to do the right thing. Instead, he and an accomplice took her across the river to an abandoned roadway, Fort Thomas. Not only did they kill her, they removed her head, in probably an attempt to obscure her identity.
Okay, so in February of 1896, this woman's headless body is lying near Fort Thomas. What were the circumstances around the discovery of her body?
Yeah, it was a very sensational, and newspapers coast to coast, literally from Oregon to Maine, carried this story, and many of them called this the crime of the century. They did not know who the body was for several days. A shoe retailer named Lewis Pook from the Newport, Kentucky area happened to look into shoes of the girl and saw the inscription, Lewis and Hayes of Greencastle, Indiana. And that led them to send back to Greencastle from Cincinnati, and they were able to determine Poor Brian had, in fact, bought that pair of shoes the previous November.
And you note in your book that this Newport shoe guy did this sort of quasi-investigation all on his own.
All on his own.
And yeah. had only his own resources.
As a matter of fact, he went, the inscriptions in the shoes indicated that the Drew Selby and Company from Portsmouth, Ohio, was a manufacturer, and the Pook, the shoe guy, went to Portsmouth and determined that this shoe had, in fact, been sent to Lewis and Hayes in Greencastle. And we know he did that because in his testimony, he was complaining that he had not been reimbursed for his expense for that trip.
Okay, so you mentioned that this was a story that garnered media coverage in the late 19th century across the nation. What was so important to people at that time that it was followed so closely and so broadly?
Well, I think the circumstances of the headless body was more than anything else, and the mystery of who it was. In the days following the discovery of the body, several people came forward and said, I know who this is. I know who this body is. And various women would read that, and they'd come forward and said, no, that is not me. That is not my body. I'm alive and well. And then several days later, then, when they find out through the shoes that it was Pearl.
How was the local media covering the story at that time? We had several newspapers in town on both sides of the river. How did they cover it?
The local media in Cincinnati or in Greencastle?
Well, I guess both.
Both. In Greencastle, the first few days following the discovery of the body, there was no reason to believe that any Greencastle person was involved. So the Bryan family and anybody from Greencastle was reading about this like anybody else in the newspapers in the country. A few days later, when they were able to find that who it was, find out it was Pearl, the news from Greencastle was drastically different.
So why all these years later does the story of Pearl Bryan and her tragic killing still pique so much curiosity?
The story's just been perpetuated all these years. After I did all this research, I went back to the Bryan family and showed them what I had. And they were happy. They were able to get a little bit of closure to finally find out what happened to their Aunt Pearl. And we decided to do a public presentation in Greencastle about this story. It was something that it took me about 2 days to do. I couldn't do it at one setting. And at the end of the presentation, somebody asked, when's the book coming out? So that's how the book itself got started.
The number is 513-419-7100 if you have questions or comments. Let's go to the phones. We have Mark on the line. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm fine. It's a very interesting program. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening. What's your question?
Well, I was wondering if the author, I've heard several accounts as to where the body was found, but not exactly, if he knows exactly where in the present, current day Fort Thomas, where it was. Is there a house address or a street or an intersection?
Okay, Mark.
Does he know the,
I'll ask the question to our author friend, Larry. I'll hang up and give him a chance to answer. I'll let the listeners know also that Larry wears hearing aids, so we don't have headphones on him currently, so he couldn't hear the question. So I'll repeat it to you now. And that call was from Mark, and he wants to know where specifically Pearl Bryan's body was found in the Fort Thomas that we know today.
Okay, now, that was a very good question. On the John Locke farm, which is only a few blocks from the entrance of the fort, there was an abandoned roadway, and that's where they took her and killed her, and the body was found on the abandoned roadway.
Was it close to the road, or was it deep into woods or on some farmland?
The abandoned roadway connected Alexandria Pike with what's now Fort Thomas Avenue. And the roadway about 600 to 800 feet long at that point. Those two roads went farther. They paralleled each other, but then they went angled together and they met about a quarter of a mile south of that point.
And your presentation coming up this week on Thursday, May 9th, is going to be at the mess hall in Fort Thomas's Tower Park. So was it, are we talking about that general area? Was it somewhere near that old military base?
Yes, it was very close to the military base. Yes.
Okay. We're going to continue our conversation about the new book chronicling the murder of Pearl Bryan and that aftermath just ahead. Plus, a chat with a Cincinnati-born entertainer who ditched his corporate life at Procter & Gamble for a shot at fame on the national stand-up comedy circuit, and later Cincinnati Zoo director Thane Maynard, and a discussion on conservation efforts in Kenya. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A new book details the life and murder of Pearl Bryan, whose death was called the crime of the century back in 1896 when her headless body was found near Fort Thomas. The betrayal of Pearl Bryan, unraveling the Gilded Age mystery that captivated a nation, is by author Larry Tippin. He's also the Putnam County, Indiana historian and is our guest in the studio today. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to ask questions or offer a comment. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. So, Larry, when we talked about Pearl Bryan moments ago, we mentioned that she had lied to her family. She told them that she was going to Indianapolis, but she ended up in Cincinnati to confront the man that she claims, or that you discovered, was the father of her unborn child. So we get introduced in your story to a couple of men who ultimately are tried for this crime, Alonzo Walling and Scott Jackson. Who were they?
Okay, first off, Scott Jackson was a dental student that had come to Greencastle for the 6 months in the middle of 1895 where his sister lived. And that's how Scott Jackson came to Greencastle. When he went to dental college, before he went to dental college, he had been in New Jersey. He was born in Maine, went to New Jersey, and got in trouble with the law. Came to Greencastle to live with his sister, and then was a dental student there. And then he went to dental college first in Indianapolis and then Cincinnati. The reason he came to Cincinnati was because he got in trouble with the law yet again when he was in Indianapolis. And his mother wanted to come to Cincinnati to get him away from the influence of Indianapolis men, unable to acknowledge that Jackson himself was a bad influence. And both in Indianapolis and then in Cincinnati, Alonzo Walling was also a dental student at that time. And basically, Jackson and Walling ended up rooming together while they were in the dental college here in Cincinnati.
Okay, so Bryan arrives in Cincinnati, and these guys in some testimony claim that they were looking to meet with her. So they had all colluded on this. They had intended to meet here in Cincinnati. And Pearl went out looking for these men. She ultimately didn't find them in those early hours that she was here. So she checked into the Indiana Lodge.
Well, what happened was idiots, they went to the wrong train station.
So they missed each
other. They missed each other because of that. Pearl was able to track them down the next morning at the Dental College in Cincinnati.
But she used a false name when she checked into her overnight lodging. Right. She used the name Mabel Stanley. Mm-hmm. How did you track that information down?
That's interesting. Pearl had a sister named Mary Stanley. And probably because she didn't want to use her own name, she took her sister Mary Stanley's name and twisted it around and made up a person named Mabel Stanley. There never was a person named Mabel Stanley. Pearl never had a sister named Mabel. And that's what she did.
Any idea why she did that?
Probably because she didn't want to register under her own name. And she just, that was just the name she thought of. Probably the first thing that came to her mind.
So eventually, Brian, Walling, and Jackson were all able to meet up. And after this crime took place, in court testimony, there were various witnesses who said that they had seen this trio making moves, Newport, Bellevue, on both sides of the river, they were spotted. But you suggest in the title of this book that Brian was betrayed. So what was the betrayal?
Well, when Scott Jackson had went to Greencastle to visit his family for the Christmas holidays, 1895, knew that he was the father of the unborn child. When he came back to Cincinnati, he was telling people how he was going to lure Pearl to Cincinnati and kill her. And it very graphically described what he was going to do to the body and to the evidence and dispose of the evidence, which is pretty much exactly what he did. And that's why I call it the betrayal, because it was very much a premeditated crime. And Pearl thought that she was going to be able to convince him to do the right thing. But instead, his intention was all along, he was going to kill her.
And so Brian ends up dead. Her body is found in Fort Thomas. First, how were they able to identify Pearl Bryan's body when her head wasn't attached?
Well, there's a few things. Interestingly, like I said, this Lewis Pook, the shoe retailer, looked in the shoes and saw the inscription. In the inscription, the name Lewis and Hayes, Greencastle. So the authorities from Cincinnati went to Greencastle. They went to Lewis and Hayes shoe store. They could not find anything in their first look. They wasted a whole day tracing down false leads, and they were basically ready to come home. Pearl's brother Frank telegraphed the friend in Indianapolis, who telegraphed back saying, "I have no idea what you're talking about. Pearl's not here, and she's not been here." So the telegraph operator that received that telegraph happened to know Jackson and the Bryan family, took it to the authorities, who then went to the Bryan home and showed the Bryan family the dress, the undergarments that Pearl was wearing with the blood-stained handprint in the back. And that's how they identified her. And then Pearl's family also mentioned she had distinguishing physical characteristics on her hands and on her feet, which did match the body.
And in the early stages of this investigation locally, there were other suspects, including a guy who was spotted in a river washing a bloody shirt. A few people's names came up.
That's exactly right. Somebody was washing a bloody shirt, and there was another one that had some suspicion, and they were both eventually cleared. No connection with the crime for those two men, yeah.
And ultimately, the story ends up back in Greencastle after some clues are put together, thanks to some shoe sleuthing, some true gumshoe detective work.
And then there's more to that. When they identified the family, Pearl had a second cousin named Will Wood.
Another man features prominently in Brian's story that we see in Greencastle portion of your story. His name is Will Wood. So who is he?
He was a second cousin of Pearl Bryan, happened to live next door to Scott Jackson's sister. So he and Jackson had become good friends in the short time that Jackson was in Greencastle. He had gone to South Bend as going to be a medical student. And after the Bryan family identified the belongings of Pearl, they told the authorities they should go to South Bend and check on Will Woods because he has to know something about this, whether he's directly involved or not. They wired ahead to the postmaster in South Bend, told him to hold any letters coming or going from Will Wood. When they got to South Bend, they found that Scott Jackson had, in fact, written two letters to Will Wood, both of them highly incriminating, where he all but admitted, or basically did admit, that he had done something bad to Pearl, and he asked Wood to stick with him. And that's how Jackson was identified. And then after they arrested Jackson, he was in his jail cell that evening, very late at night, and asked, has Walling been arrested yet? To which the jailer said, no, should he be? So that's how Walling got arrested and connected.
So were they tried together? Were they tried separately?
They were tried separately. They, when they first brought them in, they questioned them sometimes together, sometimes separately. They gave details only somebody that was intimate with the crime would know, but they never confessed. That's all the way to the very end. Walling asked that he could be tried separately because, you know, he knew he was an accomplice. He had almost all but admitted it, but he didn't admit it. But he thought maybe he could get a lighter sentence if he was tried separately. So they had the Jackson trial first, then the Walling trial, and they were both tried. Then they were both hung, was what became the last public hanging in Campbell County, Kentucky.
They were hanged together.
They were hanged together.
You've got photos in the book.
Matter of fact, the sheriff wanted it set so he could pull the lever just once because he didn't think he would have the nerve to do it twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So the name of the book, of course, is The Betrayal of Pearl Bryant, Unraveling the Gilded Age Mystery That Captivated a Nation. It does more than explore the facts of this case. Towards the end, you offer this guide to historic markers connected to Pearl Bryant's life, both in Greencastle and to the crime here in the Cincinnati area. So that's all very fascinating. And you also include your conclusions and your personal analysis after looking over this. What do you think you learned about this case that wasn't known previously?
Well, I learned a lot, of course. In most of the chapters of the book, I cite my sources, of which there are many. I had over 800 sources, thousands of pages of primary source documentation, but there were just a few questions that we could not get answered. So I express my opinions on some of those. And, you know, it's basically fascinating to be able to just put this together. After I compared the evidence from the trial transcripts, the newspaper accounts, the depositions, and it's everything just really fit together. I was able to create a timeline exactly how everything happened with just a few unanswered questions, which I expressed my opinion about. And another interesting point I forgot to mention, they put Pearl's head in her own bag, her valise, which was in Cincinnati for several days.
So we do know where her head ended up.
We do know where her head was. And then the valise ended up at a different location, but the head did not.
Well, one thing that we got to make clear in our last 30 seconds is you don't believe that Pearl Bryant's head ended up on the site where Bobby Mackey's supposedly haunted country western tavern is in Wilder.
The physical evidence indicates it could not have possibly ended up there. There's only two places I think it could have ended up, and you really need to get the book so you can read that.
Our thanks to Larry Tippin for joining us today. He'll discuss the book in a presentation at the Mess Hall in Fort Thomas's Tower Park on Thursday, May 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. Details at WVXU.org. Thank you, Larry. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.